Hi, everybody. Before we get started on the podcast today, I just want to give a big shout out and a thanks to all of you who've been listening for, yes, an entire year. I didn't even realize the podcast had been up and running that long until I got an email from one of you saying, 52 episodes? Does that mean you've been on a whole year? Well, yes, it does. So today marks the beginning of year two, and it's a good one. And I would love to hear from as many of you as possible, because I'm going to give away the book that we're going to talk about today called The Road Back to You. It's a fascinating book published by InterVarsity Press on the Enneagram, a wonderful personality profile system that I'm actually trained to teach. But today you're going to hear from two master teachers. They're amazing. And I just want to say thank you for being with me for this entire first year. So many of you have emailed and encouraged me. And here's how you can connect with me today to get in on the drawing. And I'll probably wait a week, because I know you download and listen at your convenience. So I'll at least wait a week before I draw, okay? So you can send me your name and mailing address when you email me at this address. Email faithconvo@gmail.com. All right, that's short for Faith Conversations, obviously. faithconvo@gmail.com. Also, I've heard from many of you who have been so generous in contributing to the podcast. As you know, I love doing this, but it doesn't pay anything. So I am piecing together my income this way through the podcast, through media coaching, and through doing spiritual direction. And I have a number of Skype clients for spiritual direction. And you can contact me also at that email address if you're interested in spiritual direction. So here's how you can contribute to the podcast. You can just send a check to Anita Lustria. The mailing address is 905 South Ardmore Avenue, 905 South Ardmore Avenue, A-R-D-M-O-R-E Avenue, Villa Park, Illinois. Two words, Villa Park, V as in Victor, Villa Park, Illinois, 60181. Again, the zip, 60181. And now, let's get on with it. I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today, I am at InterVarsity Press. I'm delighted to have sitting across the table from me, Ian Morgan Crone and Suzanne Stabile. And what I'm excited about especially is today we get to talk about a favorite topic of mine, and that is the Enneagram. I've been waiting for a book to come out that I can recommend to friends, and there are loads of great Enneagram books out there, but this is a wonderful and understandable Enneagram book that I am recommending far and wide. And if you're unfamiliar with the Enneagram, you're going to want to grab a copy as well. It's called The Road Back to You, An Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery. But before I get into all that, let me remind you that you can find out more about Faith Conversations when you go to AnitaLustria.com. And I hope you'll do that. I'll have all the information about our guests this week, how to connect with them, more information about the book, all of that at AnitaLustria.com. And at the end, I'll let you know a little bit about how you can support Faith Conversations as well. So let's get into introductions. Ian Morgan Crone is a best-selling author. He's a nationally recognized speaker. He's an Enneagram teacher, counselor, and man, he's done more things than any of us combined, pretty much. But what I'm going to say is he's a favorite author of mine. He wrote the book Chasing Francis, which is one of the favorites that I've read in the past 5 years. And Ian, it's probably came out less than 5 years ago, right?
That particular edition, yeah, okay. About maybe 3 years ago. Yeah.
All right, so one of the best books I've read in the last 3 years. There you go.
Thank you.
So welcome to Faith Conversations.
Thank you for having us.
And Suzanne Stabile is a sought-after speaker, teacher, internationally recognized Enneagram master teacher. And she is traveling around the country, maybe the world, I'll find out, doing workshops most weeks of the year. You can catch her somewhere. And we'll have, again, I'll have links to all of the websites that we mention or talk about here today. And Suzanne, along with her husband, Reverend Joseph Stabile, are co-founders of Life in the Trinity Ministry. It's a nonprofit, non-denominational ministry committed to spiritual growth and formation of adults. And she finds her home in Dallas, Texas. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I want to know how the two of you connected for the first time and decided to write a book on the Enneagram. And then we'll talk about what the Enneagram is. But tell how you guys met first.
I'll tell that and you can tell the book part. How's that?
Okay.
All right. So I got a call to come and speak at a conference in Texas at Bright Divinity School at TCU. And I was persuaded by this remarkable woman, this ball of energy on the phone. I can remember the time I was really tired. I'd done a lot of speaking. I was going to stay home for a while. But I was, you know, once you get to know Suzanne, you realize that's it's pretty hard to resist her, you know. And so I went, and I remember within about 10 minutes of meeting her, thinking to myself, you know, I could get arrested with this person. You know, this is a person I could get arrested with, and we could have a lot of fun together. And, you know, we just became great friends. And then I went to a workshop of hers on the Enneagram. And, you know, I've been to, other trainings and been around it, you know, in years before, but I found her to be, you know, just a very compelling voice. And I refer to her as the Mrs. Miyagi of, you know, the Enneagram. I'm the Karate
great.
Kid, and she's
yeah.
Mrs. Miyagi. She's,
I love that.
Know.
Which I'll just interject. I had a couple of friends, Suzanne, go to one of your conferences, seminars, whatever you call
sure.
it, workshops. And they said it was like nothing they had been to before. They loved it and learned more than they had at other in other settings. So I wanted to pass that on to you.
Thank you.
And so then the writing of the book, the two of you, I decided, or did you convince Ian to be a part of the process? How did that come about?
Well, after we had invited Ian to be part of our conference, he invited me to be part of Faith and Courage, which is a wonderful, wonderful program that he sponsored. And I would just say at this point, because I'm afraid I'll forget later, I've never met anybody who sets the table for other speakers and for other artists like Ian does. He creates space. Mm. And then he introduces you to the people who inhabit the space. And then he is present but not while you do what you do. I don't know anybody who does it better.
Wow.
So he invited me to do that, and I did. And then we met each other's families and each other's children. And on a otherwise ordinary Sunday afternoon, I got a text from Ian that said, I have an idea. And I knew him well enough by then to know that can mean so many things. So I texted back and said, what is it? And he said, we should talk. For a long time, prior to that phone call, I had been saying that Ian is one of my top 10 favorite authors, and I read a lot. And while most people really identify more closely, I guess, with Chasing Francis, Jesus, My Father, The CIA in Me is one of my top three books that I've ever read.
Okay.
I read it in an afternoon, and then I got up the next day and read it again.
Wow. Okay.
And I think the reason for that is that Ian's such a good storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And I think stories are the best hospitality we have to offer one another. So I was taken with that. So he then, when we talked, said, let's write an Enneagram book. And predictably, I guess, for me, I said, well, I'll think about it. I had publicly said many times that I would never write a book because it's historically been an oral tradition, and I value that, and I love teaching it. I thought, I don't know, because I'm going to undo something I've said for a long time. But his reasons were that he thought we could really add something to conversations in the world, particularly intergenerationally, which is a great lack. And he had an audience in mind that he shared that we might be able to really help young adults honor their parents and the tradition that they grew up in, but maybe step out of it just a bit, and that they needed a language to do that, and that the Enneagram might be that language.
Oh, I love that. Love that reason.
So I went to see my therapist, and I went to see my spiritual director, and my husband Joe and I prayed about it, and I was just about decided to do it, and actually we went to P.F. Chang's for dinner, and they handed me my fortune cookie. And they didn't just set them on the table. She handed it to me. So I knew that somehow that one was for me. And I opened it and it said, "You are a lover of words. You should write a book someday." So I called Ian on the way home from the restaurant and said, "I'm in."
I love that. For those unfamiliar with the Enneagram, this is the point where I would love for one of you to explain what the Enneagram is. I love it. It you know, I feel like God has used it to transform my life in so many ways. But how do you describe it to people?
Well, there are so many doorways into this conversation, which is in part why the book was so long and a real wrestle. You know, I mean, there's so many ways into the conversation about what the Enneagram is. First, for sake of brevity, it's an ancient personality typology that helps people understand and gives them language to describe 9 personality styles or ways of being in the world that in many ways obscure or hide the authentic self that we were born to be, you know? And these personalities, personas from the mm-hmm. Greek, right, derivative of the Greek word, they serve a function when we're kids, you know. They protect us from the vagaries and the vicissitudes of childhood, right? All the inevitable losses mm-hmm. and wounds that come with it. Unfortunately, they stick around longer than they should. And as Carl Jung, this is a very bad translation of what he said, but, you know, that which kept you alive in the morning will kill you at night. And so, you know, these are, in fact, I was thinking on the way here about this, that you know, that these are baby clothes we're still wearing. And they're very uncomfortable when you're, you know, a bigger person.
Yeah.
You know, they're tight and they're not supposed to be fit the way they are. So what it does is...
It's a good picture.
What the Enneagram does actually, I'm sorry I'm going so long, but it's not an easy question to answer, actually. Mm-hmm. I get scared every time I answer it. But it helps us to recognize and disidentify with those parts of our personalities that are now, as, you know, older adult people continually, repeatedly, predictably tripping us up and preventing us from living into our fullest, truest, best selves. How was that, Suze? That's the best I could do. How was it?
I thought it was really good. We might have an elevator speech now.
Really?
Yeah, but you'll have to be in the elevator because I can't do it.
Well, it's going to have to be 70 floors.
That was
a Freedom Tower speech right there, honey.
No, I can give that one.
That's good.
yeah, and maybe on the heels of that explanation and talking about the, you know, living into our true self, who we truly are, I think for a long time, at least circles that I have come from, people were afraid to walk down that path, or we weren't encouraged to really get to know our true self. That's a pretty critical to this conversation, and even to our lives in Christ. It's critical to know ourselves. I'd love for you to speak to that a little bit.
I thought I knew myself. I think we all do. And I thought my personality was this really great thing that was helping me make my way in the world. And it is that. It is great, and it is that. But the reality is the best part of you is also the worst part of you. So a good way to talk about that might be for me to say that I'm a 2 on the Enneagram, so I'm a helper or a giver. And I am, by nature, helpful, generous, fairly kind, very aware of other people and what their needs might be. And in the moments or times when I can do that altruistically, that's actually lovely. But I can use those exact same gifts to control and manipulate and get my way and make people feel bad about themselves. And everything contains its opposite. And that includes our personalities. So what the Enneagram offered me first was a way to recognize that there's a limited good in my 2-ness. And there's a limited good in Ian's 4-ness. And if we could allow the excess to fall away, then we could just be more holistically healthy. Also, I thought I knew myself, but I didn't know that I could do anything about the parts of myself that I didn't like. So I thought I was responsible for carrying this guilt or this shame with me and somehow managing that while trying not to do it anymore. And I never realized that I had the natural resources inside of me that I needed to be who I believe God created me to be.
And even in hearing that full response, I'm thinking of so many people when they first approach the Enneagram and read about the 9 different types and maybe start gravitating toward one. There, at least this is my experience, my initial reaction was, oh, really? That's me? You know, that kind of thing. But your fuller explanation of really learning more and having the resources to do something about that maybe more shadow side or however you describe that. Because there are beautiful, you can live in a healthy manner or an unhealthy manner, no matter what number you end up being on the Enneagram. And I think that's probably an important piece for people to recognize. Mm. You know, we can live a lot of ways, but certainly I think it gave me, all of a sudden, I had great hope when I realized, oh, I can live out of this shadow side, or I can live in a more healthy way. And some of that is up to me. And what you just said, Suzanne, you know, to realize that you do have those resources to move that direction. Yeah, which is no small thing.
Right. One of our ways of talking about it is to say that everybody feels like you do, Anita, yeah, when they first hear their number, mm-hmm, with one exception.
Yes.
And there is one personality type that hears their number and thinks, yeah.
7. No. Who is it? I've got to think here.
It's generally 8.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And they're aware that, yeah, that's me, and I get a lot done, and if there were more 8s in the world, it would be
better. It'd be a better place.
That's right.
Oh, that's funny. One question I have, I've had people ask me this who are kind of getting to know the Enneagram. What age is it, are you able to really tell what someone's number is going to be? You know, their parents probably listening to this, moms, maybe some dads, thinking, oh, can I read about this and sort of pinpoint who my kids likely are, or at what age can I do that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the Enneagram can be, what are you going to say something?
I was going to say that largely, and we're talking about self-discovery, so even in the question I'm asking, you know, it's not really something you want to do is to pinpoint someone else's number.
Right.
But as parents, you know how we want to know our kids better, mm-hmm, and, you know, potentially we could use it as a tool, a helpful tool, but I don't know when kids are formed enough for us to really make or to understand what number they are, and then I'll just let you
sure
answer.
So first of all, I think you made a good point, right, which is we should let other people do their own work, right, and we should encourage them and love them in that process, and we can't, based on their traits, really know their Enneagram personality style. That's something they have to determine based on what they begin to sense is the underlying motivation for that mm-hmm set or that constellation of behaviors and traits. I think parents have to be very careful of actually, particularly at a young age, trying to say, okay, this kid's this or this kid's that, because actually the self in many ways that we develop of ourselves, or the way that we perceive ourselves as young people is formed by others, right? So, you know, if you start talking to a kid like, oh, this kid's an 8, well, that kid, you may be actually thrusting onto that kid something that isn't them. I mean, you may be doing the very thing that, you know, is thwarting why you would want to use the Enneagram in the first place, right? So I think if all it does is, as a parent, make you curious about who your kid is, I think that's wonderful. I think as they get older into their teen years and there's sort of the self becomes more independent and florid, you might have an opportunity to make some, you know, guesstimates of what they are, but I would just say that at a certain point, just making it available to them and saying, you know, like we did with our daughter, our daughter is a beautiful, wonderful 8, and you know, I just had to leave it on a table in a room and say to my wife, boy, I read this book, it was great, and then I walked out, left it on the table, and 2 days later it was gone.
Yeah.
And just let them do it themselves.
That's good.
We both had our children read the book or listen or figure it out themselves. Mm-hmm. I didn't assign numbers to our children.
Yeah. I had one in mind for my son, but I didn't, you know, necessarily name it.
I would just say I think it's impossible to learn about the Enneagram and not have a number in mind for most of the people in your life. It changes how you think, and then you just intuitively, automatically think, I bet he's a, and mm-hmm. I bet she's a. And I think that's okay, as long as you leave room for the fact that you very likely could be wrong. And I don't think we want to rob anybody else of the journey of finding their own number.
Yeah, and so I'll just add one more thing.
Yeah,
and
good.
That is, you know, the Enneagram is a tool that's like a flashlight looking into a giant mystery. You know, human beings are complex, mysterious. How we, the collision of forces that create who we are is, you know, mind-boggling, right? And it's a helpful tool, but if we overreach with it, you know, and say so-and-so is an eight, well, that's kind of a ridiculous assertion, right? That what we could say is that, well, through the lens of this particular system, this person, you know, I am a four, but that can't possibly capture the enormous, you know, what it means to be a person made in the image of God with all of that mystery and beauty. Now, maybe I'm talking like a four right
well,
now, but I mean, you know, I do think that, you know, we have to be careful that we don't actually weaponize it in
yeah.
such a way that we, you know, think that we've completely wrapped everybody up with a bow and we can walk away knowing who they are.
Yeah.
But in fact, Suzanne would always say, actually, once you know your Enneagram number, what you actually know is who you aren't.
Yeah, that's good. And I'm also thinking you can stand there next to another four or another two, or and, you know, you can be as
right.
opposite. That's the big mystery. It can be, you know, you can think, no way, but yes, you can be.
Talk about paint.
Oh, she likes it. Well, that's not even original to me, but the idea is that if you go down, you know, if you believe that there's only nine numbers, you know, and yet that bothers you, that there's only nine personality styles in the world, I say, well, just, you know, go to Home Depot and look
mm-hmm.
at the paints, you know, go look at the Ralph Lauren paint chip section, and
yeah.
you'll see that, by the way, that there's about a trillion, you know, in fact, scientifically, we know that there's, you know, a gajillion, there's like an endless number
yeah.
of shades of brown,
mm-hmm.
right? And so if you're, you know, a four, there's an infinite number
right.
of shades and hues of fours. So you are that little snowflake mama said you were, but
good to know.
You're still brown. You see, that's the thing. You're still brown. It's just that you're a variation of brown, you know,
yeah.
four or five, whatever that is,
mm-hmm.
it can be analogued of, you know, that's the...
For listeners who know the Enneagram, I just want to say that I can fairly closely read your moods based on what color you pick when you tell that story.
Oh, that's hilarious. Really? For real?
Absolutely.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I hope I'm
scary.
In a pretty good mood right now. I'm earthy.
Brown.
I'm feeling earthy.
Great.
That could go a lot of places
yes,
right now.
Could.
I'm just going to leave it alone.
Question. What makes the Enneagram so interesting to you over any number of other personality profile systems that are out there?
Well, so I'm a therapist, and
yes.
and I mean, I haven't had a private practice in years, but I'm still a trained therapist,
mm-hmm.
and I was exposed to psychometrics and things like the Minnesota Multiphasic Inventory or the Myers-Briggs or the Strong Campbell, all these different things. One of the things I love about the Enneagram is that it, compared to other systems, is far more dynamic than static. Which I think is actually a good thing, because that's true of the human personality. I like what James Hollis says about the idea that the word self actually is a verb. It's not a noun. Isn't that a cool idea?
Yeah.
So he talks about selfing.
That
a human
good.
Being is always selfing. You know, it's not like we're trapped in a box and we have this sort of predetermined, you know, we self all the time.
Hmm.
And so what the Enneagram does is it takes that into account, you know, that we can be healthy. So if you think vertically, we can be healthy or average or unhealthy in our number, right? So that's that mm-hmm. great work of Riso and Hudson. Or, you know, we can, in stress, go and begin to look a whole lot like another number because we go and grab some resources over there. Or we can go and feel good and we can go over here. And so it moves. The system is flexible and not brittle. And I really think that gives it an advantage. And then lastly, I'd say is that it shows you your junk, and those other systems will not show you your junk.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that I
yeah.
love the Enneagram.
Yeah, but
for here, that.
So the like one of the things we'll talk about tomorrow, we'll talk about just the importance of self-compassion in every context, how important that is for change, that there's no real change that happens without it.
I think the fact that it shows you your junk is what makes it a spiritual wisdom tool.
Yes.
Right. As well. Because of God's grace, we are not left with an awareness that we don't have a capacity to do something about. And so it can help us take care of ourselves in times of fear or shame or anger. Mm-hmm. We have a chance.
Yeah.
I like that. What about, I mean, I'm looking at the Enneagram. I know that it is, I feel like it has helped me in my marriage. But, you know, my husband knows what his number is. And, you know, you're not supposed to type someone else. But, you know, what if you're the really interested party and your spouse is just not really interested in figuring out their number? Can it still be a help to you in your marriage?
Oh, absolutely. Just in general, anyway, you know, when someone says to me, how do I fix my husband or my wife or my marriage, I say, work on yourself.
Yeah. Thank you.
Be as healthy as you can be.
Your kid's not sober, okay, work on yourself, you know, because we really don't, it's not our purview to move into another human being's life. And actually what our job is, talking about Thomas Merton, really, is to learn how to love the other for who the other is versus who they might become, to make our life better or easier. And so, you know, I would counsel someone who's thinking, man, I know my number. I want my husband or wife or partner to know their number so we can, you know, begin to communicate at this level to just continue to grow as a human being and by virtue of attraction, you know, make that person want to do their own work with the Enneagram. And when you do know, this was such a kind of an idea that comes up in the book but it was so important for me is, you know, the Enneagram, once you know another person's number, it should never be used for any other reason than to be encouraging, to move them toward actualization as a human being, to become their self, and never to pigeonhole them or to use it as a way of dismissing them. Because I hear that all the time. Well, you're being such a six. And I'm always like, when I hear that, my hackles go up. And you don't want to get Suzanne's hackles up. I'll tell you, that ain't good.
Well, I will say my husband and I will joke about it. You can do that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You probably, I mean, you got some license in your marriage to do that, but sure. You know.
I would just add two things to that. And one is, you know, the Enneagram, there weren't books published about the Enneagram before the 1970s.
Oh, and wow. I didn't realize that.
Back in the day.
I hadn't paid attention to that time.
Yeah. Back in the day when spiritual directors or spiritual masters taught the Enneagram to their directees or the people they were working with, they only taught you your number because you're the only thing you can do anything about.
Wow. Very interesting.
And along with Ian's concern that we might use the Enneagram in a way that's hurtful to other people, the other side of that is your Enneagram number is never an excuse for your behavior.
Right.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that.
And so what we're trying to do is make personality a little smaller. And every time you use that excuse, you just make your personality bigger. So that line of, well, I'm just a two, I can't do it any differently, or
just
I'm
the way
one.
I am.
That's right. That has no space in this work.
Yeah, in fact, once you know your Enneagram number, we just took your excuse away. I mean, it's sort of like you might want to think twice about coming to a conference because it's like, oh, well, okay. You know, but because after this, you know, you're kind of, it's like, you know, I've been in AA for 28 years, and we often say in meetings, you know, once someone tells you you're an alcoholic, it just really messes up your drinking.
That's good.
From that moment on, it's like, oh, man.
It's over.
Really?
Okay. So you have to take responsibility for yourself and for your behavior, and you have everything you need to do that.
You know, I know, I mean, people need to get the book. It's called The Road Back to You, and to read the fuller explanation of the nine types, but I know there are, you know, a couple of word descriptions of each type that might be interesting just to zip through that might pique someone's interest.
Back and forth?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, ones good. Are the perfectionist. These are people who get up in the morning and they see a world that's rife with error and needs improvement, right? And so their eyes are immediately drawn to what's out of order, needs fixing. And they feel a burden of responsibility to actually fix it themselves, right? And, you know, I honestly, I know I'm going long on this, aren't I? Yikes, sorry.
Yeah.
But, you know,
good.
ones oftentimes come to conferences and they, you know, of course they're very hard on themselves because they're perfectionists, you know, mm-hmm. they have these voices in their head of running negative self-commentary. And I, in the book, I tried so hard to highlight the beauty of ones in talking about Atticus Finch, you know, that beautiful person who just models integrity and dependability and goodness. And so ones, man, when they're healthy, are extraordinary human beings. And I will make all the other answers short. You take two now. You take two and three. I went long. I'm one.
Twos are helpers or givers. And they read the world with feelings. And they respond to what they perceive with doing something. So their talk style is help and advice. The problem is they help people who don't want their help. They tire themselves out doing for others and return to their own lives without enough energy left for self-care. Mm-hmm. They really do make everybody feel comfortable. Mm. People are comfortable with twos. They kind of feel at home with twos. Twos are insightful and aware of how they might be helpful to you. Mm. Threes, there are Enneagram masters who have assigned countries a number. So the United States is a three country, and I'm from Dallas, which is a three city. Twos, threes, and fours are all concerned with image, but threes are the core number of that image concern. And the thing that I think is the most intriguing about threes is that they can be the poster child for any organization that they belong to. They can adapt and morph and shapeshift into whoever you want them to be. And they can do that for one organization in the morning, a different one in the afternoon, and another one at night. Mm. And that gift is also their problem, yeah. Of course. And they are movers and shakers. They make big decisions on behalf of people that make big differences in the world.
Mm. Fours.
Ian's a four, so he... Yeah.
Fours are the most beautiful, special. Christ-like, special people in all the world. That's
no
all I
doubt.
Need to say about
no
it.
No doubt.
Yeah. I'm a four, and we are the romantics, sometimes called the individualists. We too are part of that feeling heart triad. We are very image conscious, along with twos and threes. How we express it, of course, is very different. But we share with twos and threes this whole crisis around identity and this sort of uncertainty about even the presence of identity. And we look outside of ourselves to others to kind of glean a sense of self, you know, and we try to capture it, right, using different strategies. Mm-hmm. And so for fours, you know, we are people who think that we're really missing something, that something core at our really a fundamental flaw exists at our very mm-hmm. core that others have. And we look at other people and we envy what we perceive to be their happiness and their sense of just being in the world. It just seems so comfortable and easy for them, you know? And we feel like our nose is pressed up against the glass of the party of life looking in, and we just can't get in. And so we're very comfortable with melancholy. Lots of creatives and artists are fours. We feel like because we have this piece that's missing that we have to compensate somehow. And so, one of our great ways of doing it, of course, is to be unique and special. That's the need of that fours. We want to be really extraordinary. We're drawn to things that are even exotic, eccentric, unusual, unconventional, bohemian, avant-garde. I mean, you know, am I getting all the words, girl?
You're doing
okay,
good job.
All right. So that's what fours are like.
You're amazing.
I mean, you know, we're like a little bit like Salvador Dali, right? I mean, we're walking around the streets of New York with a big, you know, cigarette holder and a mustache. And because we think somehow or another that by embodying this kind of specialness and uniqueness that we're actually going to compensate for this missing piece somehow. And that image, right, is going to somehow or another win this love that we're so desperate to find. And so, you know, our talk style is lament, right? I love that. You know, we love a sad story, we fours. And we were just laughing right before we started about, I'm speaking tomorrow with Suzanne, and I had this opening story for the conference, and it was so sad and tragic. And I'm going, oh, they're going to love this. Because I get really moved by yes. that stuff. And then I thought to myself, No, they're going to hate that. There's going to be 8 4s in the room who are crying when I do it, and the 260 other people that are going to hate it.
That's great.
I do want to add one thing. 4 is the only number on the Enneagram that can bear witness to pain without having to fix it.
Oh, really?
And we really have a need for that. Everybody's a fixer. You know, I don't know.
That's really good. I have a good friend who's a 4, and that is really her.
Yeah.
But I had not put those words to it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, cool. We got a lot of fixers and a few 4s. Mm. And there is pain that can't be fixed.
Yes.
So to have somebody who can witness that and stand with you is quite something.
Mm. Yes.
5s on the Enneagram are the number that has a measured amount of energy, and it's like manna. You can't save up, so they get the same amount every day, and when it's gone, it's gone. So they kind of have to measure how they are with other folks. They have a desire to perceive, which means to fully understand something. So once they kind of get interested in something, if it grabs their attention, they follow it deep, deep, deep. 5s are more reserved because of that lack of energy. And they are people who tend to hoard affection and time. And if you want some of their time, you can state your case, and they'll kind of decide if it's worthy of their involvement and their participation.
That's great. I love that.
Wow. Okay, so now that brings us to 6s. Yeah. Many Enneagram teachers believe that there are more 6s in the population than any other number. And I think there's probably some good evidence that's true. I don't know what that percentage is, but clearly there's a lot of 6s.
I'm married to one.
Are you?
Yep.
Okay. Well, you can probably do this yourself, right? The 6s need, we call them something, the loyalist, right?
Yep.
Some call them the guardian. They're great people.
Yes, they are.
They are really great people. They really hold us together. When they're healthy, they are so funny and compassionate. They really are. They're Larry David. You know, they're George Costanza. I mean, they're able to see their stuff and really make you laugh.
Yep.
But, you know, their stuff is really based on fear and this need to feel secure and to feel supported. They have a need to feel secure and supported. And so they're looking at authority figures all the time. As little kids, I mean, teachers, right, love having 6s in their classroom because they just keep their eye on you and they'll follow you around like little ducklings, right?
Right.
And they watch that authority figure, though, with a certain amount of ambivalence, right? Because part of them is like, I want to submit because and win the favor of the authority figure because that authority figure actually is the key to my security. But on the other hand, there's a piece of me that doesn't really trust that authority figure because, I don't know, the world is a scary place filled with people with hidden agendas. So I'm afraid to trust that person. So part of me wants to bring them down. So there's this sort of, you know, rebel submit dynamic that goes on, vacillating back and forth with 6s. 6s, you know, they're always thinking about worst case scenarios. That's a hallmark trait because they're just always planning for the worst. You know, God bless them. They have a plan for everything. I had an aunt who was a 6, and I swear to God, she made us build a fallout shelter in the backyard and put canned beans in it. You know, and I mean, you know, there was a. She always made us look for where the fire exits were when we went to a concert. You know, because she just in case there was a bad. So they're constantly planning for it, and of course, in the current environment that we live in, being a 6 is pretty hard because we live in a culture that's humid with anxiety. You know, and that's closer to what they feel is anxiety, not fear. Fear is to be in the presence of something that's an actual danger. They just live with free-floating anxiety, generalized anxiety. Mm-hmm. Like, so that's even a little worse. I mean, you know, you can't even target it. It's just diffuse. I mean, it's everywhere. And in our culture, that's a fear and where people are manipulated by fear, whether it's by marketers or politicians. It's tough to be a 6.
7.
7s are the epicures of the Enneagram. They kind of see life as a smorgasbord, and they want to taste a little of all of it and be part of all of it and try it all. They are funny and lighthearted, and they tend to have a limited range of emotion in that they pretty much hang in the happy half. They dip over into sadness if they must, but they reframe everything very quickly. Mm. So they have lots of defense mechanisms that help them, and they reframe quickly. I feel sure the first person who ever said, "It's all good," I'm pretty sure it was a 7 on the Enneagram.
That's great.
Our son is a 7, and when he was in high school, he went out one day and had a good round of golf and came home and said, "You know, I might go ahead and go to college, but I may just go ahead and turn pro." And that's because they have magical thinking.
Oh,
and they believe
great.
Their magical thinking in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's a very dangerous place. I would say that I think it's harder for 7s to get support from those close to them for a good spiritual transformative journey than any other number.
Wow.
Because when they start to kind of look inward and get a little more serious, the rest of us encourage them to stop that and be fun and cute and entertain us like you used to.
Yeah. Wow. All right. 8s.
Yeah. Man, we both have 8s, don't we?
It's very interesting. Our children are, I have 4 and Ian has 3, but our children are the same gender,
okay.
the 3.
Yeah.
And they're the same Enneagram numbers in the same age order.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So we have a support group. The two of us get together and we can compare notes on our experience.
That's cute.
Man, 8s are called the challengers. Mm-hmm. They really are. Well, there's a good reason they're called the challengers, because they are aggressive, challenging. Sometimes they're combative. They can be combative. They're just human dynamos. You know, they have more energy than any other number on the Enneagram. And boy, they display it all the time.
I was in a job interview with an 8.
Oh,
he asked me, "What's your energy level like?" like that, of course.
Yeah.
I go, "Well, I have the energy of a 56-year-old woman." I just didn't even know quite how to answer
that.
Yeah. I go, I have good energy, but I was sort of like,
yeah.
So yeah, you know an 8 when they walk in the room.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so like they have so much energy, and what you'll experience often with an 8 is this feeling that they're radiating anger, like they want you to submit. Like they're like they want to be the alpha dog, you know, and they're trying to get every other dog in the room to go, "Oh, you're the boss." And they want you to actually acknowledge that energy's there, you know, because it's part of a strategy to protect and fend off the possibility of others seeing the vulnerable, tender side, which is there. Trust me, it is there. They are gooey at the center and they armor up, right? And then not only do they armor up, they radiate what feels like a space heater, you know, they can radiate this energy that's like an anger energy, you know, it's because that emotion is right below the surface. They can grab it in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm telling you, when they do, it's flashy, it's good. And that 8, when they're in a healthy space, that's Martin Luther King. And they're in a bad space, that's Vladimir Putin.
Mm.
So, you know, they can, this again, you know, your blessing can be your curse. If it's well channeled, then you've got something that can be really, really great. It's not really, by the way, I think their need is a really, what they have is this, it's really a need to go up against power, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think a lot of what you get from them is this intensity, this passion. It's not so much anger as it is, they're like Zorba the Greek. They're just like overcharged with eros, you know? They're overcharged with life. They're 240 volts, and they have to learn how to steward it so that they don't run roughshod over people, which they can do.
Yeah. All right. Last number, 9.
9s are peacemakers.
We're both married to 9s, yeah. By the way. So it's not just our kids, it's our spouses, too. I think, our pets are the same numbers.
Cute.
9s are the peacemakers, but in order to be a peacemaker, you have to see both sides of everything. So the best part of 9s is they see 2 sides to everything. And the worst part of 9s is that they see 2 sides to everything. 9s are also limited energy-wise because they're boundaried internally and externally. They try to keep out anything that would steal their peace, and they try to keep in anything that would cause conflict. 9s are synthesizers in a way. You remember back in the day when we had to sit and come up with mission statements for the organizations that we belong to? My gosh, I hated that.
Yeah, me too.
And you know how after you'd been there and there's white sheets of paper all over the wall and everybody's said everything they want the mission to be and there's no way it can happen. And then somebody in the room says, you know, I think I've got it. And they read three sentences. That's a nine who did that. And those sentences usually work. However, when nines are trying to make a point, they give you so many examples that you our children used to say to their daddy when they were in trouble, "I know I'm in trouble. Please only give me three examples." Because they can come up with another and another and another.
It's so funny because their talk style is epic or epic saga. So when you can tell a nine is sort of, they have this sort of meandering verbal sort of thing where they'll tell a story and you just didn't know a story could have that many details and tangential features to it. And then finally you're like, where does this story end? And at some point along the way, sometimes they forget what the story was about. They're just kind of like, this narrative is just sort of externalized.
That's great.
Once they start talking, it's hard to get them to start, but once they do, they have taken in a lot of details. In terms of the stories being tangential, I would just say that being married to one, I adore him, by the way. I think he's the best human being I know. And it's a privilege to be married to him. And he's no fun to worry with. He's not a fretter. You can't fret with him. So we'll be driving along, and I'll be worried about one of the children. We have six grandchildren. I could be worried about one of them. And I'll be kind of wringing my hands and kind of wanting to talk about that. And I'll say to him, "What do you think?" And he'll say, "You know what? I think that might be new construction over there
on the
corner."
That's right.
It's like, what? But what about this?
That's great.
You know, and one thing I want to say about nines that I grew to appreciate as we worked on the book was, you know, nines are the most, how would I say this, naturally inclined toward the spiritual life than probably any other number. And the reason for that is that nines have a special gift for merging, right? Mm-hmm. Now, between two human, when a nine merges with another human being and loses their own individual voice and take on the priorities and agendas of another, and, you know, at the expense of their own, that's not a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. That's unhealthy. But that same gift in the spiritual context, when they realize that merging isn't it, it's union, and that union with God, I think they just have an easier time with it. Mm-hmm. They're natural mystics and contemplatives. When they're healthy, they just move toward this natural union with God that, for me as a four or an eight, would be three times the amount of energy and work that they would have to expend.
That's interesting.
And in spite of the fact that their way of dealing with anger is that it's passive-aggressive, in spite of that, I would say that they are kind.
Mm-hmm. Guileless.
Very kind. A downside to everything is that they don't think their presence matters. And I think nines that get it, that their presence matters, make a contribution that somebody else couldn't have made.
Right. Yeah, that's true. We have we're loving on nines for a second. I have a daughter, Maddie, who is a nine. And I mentioned this story in the book because it's just so true of nines, I think. We used to have a lot of people in the house. I was pastor of a church, and she was a little kid. She was maybe like, you know, 3-4 years old. And she would come downstairs. We'd be 20 people in a circle in our house, you know. And she'd have her blankie, and she would always migrate in the room towards somebody and then get up in their lap and curl up like a cat and go to sleep with her blankie. I mean, she would just do this with people that, you know, she barely knew, or she just adults, you know, and they loved it when she did it. I mean, seriously, it looked like the person had just taken a Valium when she just kind of exuded this peaceful sort of spirit. And a friend said to us one time, she said, "Have you ever noticed that the people that Maddie always picks are people in crisis?" Mm-hmm. And now, of course, she's a little girl. She didn't. But I do, maybe it's like, you know, this romantic view of the father, but part of me thinks, nah, you know, Maddie wants to be a therapist now. It's almost like she could pick up on a person who needed peace, and she just went right to him.
Oh, yeah.
And gave it away. That's a healthy, that's a lovely dimension of nines. They just bring that.
Our daughter Jenny's the same way, and she also is working on a master's degree because she wants to be a therapist.
Yeah, they make great therapists. They make great therapists.
The last thing I would say about nines is that I think they're the least controlling. Mm-hmm. Of all the numbers on the Enneagram.
That's right.
And that lack of desire to be in control of other people and how things turn out and all that, man, that's lovely. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of that, but it's lovely.
Right. But you see, what's so interesting about every number, right, is that's lovely until it isn't. Right? And
yeah,
being a
right.
four is lovely. You know, being someone mm-hmm. that's creative and all that stuff is great until it isn't, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, it, this is the great thing about the Enneagram is it's not, you know, as David Benner said, you know, don't work with the Enneagram if what you seek after is flattery.
Oh, great quote. Great quote. Might be a good place to wrap it up. This is good stuff. I think that this has whetted people's appetites for more that are unfamiliar with the Enneagram. Those of you who have been looking for that great resource to pass on to a friend, this is it for sure. It's called The Road Back to You, an Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery. I do want to mention before we wrap up, there's also a great study guide that goes with it. Any word about the study guide? How does that work? Questions that you can
well the two things I would say are that the study guide contains material that's not in the book.
Okay.
And the second thing I would say is that Ian created a piece of work for the study guide that I think is and will be one of the best spiritual practices people will ever have available to
excellent.
Them. And it's
well,
called SNAP.
Thank you, ma'am.
Oh, excellent.
Thank
okay.
you, ma'am.
I'm excited to get into the study guide. I'm just seeing that for the first time, and I love the Enneagram. It's been significant in my own life and in the lives of people close to me. So I hope you will check out The Road Back to You. Ian Morgan Crone, Suzanne Stabile, thanks so much for being with me on Faith Conversations.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
good to
you
have
very
you.
Much.
I told you all at the beginning I'd let you know if you wanted to get involved with Faith Conversations. You can do that financially. You can just send a check, 905 South Ardmore Avenue. In Villa Park, Illinois, and the zip is 60181. You might have to rewind that to get it, but that's okay. Thanks, everybody. I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations.